Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dave Iverson of KQED Public Radio and Television. We welcome all of our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers today, former Senators Bill Bradley and Alan K. Simpson. I should note that we got off to an interesting start as we walked into the room today. Senator Bradley was stopped several times to sign basketballs. When Senator Simpson was asked what he should sign, he said money. So we're already off to an appropriate beginning. Senator Simpson and Bradley are really here today to examine the impact of big money on our political system. The discussion that we're going to have will focus on money and its influences, on who runs for office, who gets elected, and the ability of elected representatives, of course, to stay in office. We're going to also explore why both of these senators now support public funding of federal elections and the reasons they're behind their affiliation with a movement called Americans for Campaign Reform. We're going to start out with introductory comments from each of the senators. And we will start with Senator Bill Bradley. He is, of course, a former All-American and Hall of Fame basketball player, a Rhodes Scholar, former U.S. Senator from New Jersey, and, of course, a presidential candidate in the year 2000. His most recent book is called The New American Story. Senator Bradley, if you'd begin with a few opening comments, please.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back at the Commonwealth Club. I've addressed this group, I don't know, five or six times on everything from water to taxes. And it is a pleasure to be back today, in particular with my friend Al Simpson, who is a politician that I respect and that a friend that I care deeply about. And we are both here because we are concerned about the role of money in politics. That's why we are two of the four co-chairs of the Americans for Campaign Reform. And we are here today as a part of that effort. But what qualifies me to talk about money in politics is that I was in politics about 20 years. I was in the Senate 18 years. And a lot of times things happen in the Senate that are important, and sometimes things happen that are somewhat funny. And I remember one senator, I won't mention his state or his name. It was named by Washingtonian Magazine, a little bit before I got to the Senate, as being one of the 10 dumbest people in Washington. And a week later, against the advice of his staff, he called a press conference to deny it. And when you are a senator, you write laws, you fight for your constituents before the federal bureaucracy, but you're also a politician, which means you raise money and you campaign for other candidates. And I remember I was campaigning for a candidate. I hadn't really met him. I was doing the party's work. I met him in the morning, and we were going to the event. I had some biography, and I thought I would like to have a conversation with him, maybe get a feel so I could speak more poignantly to his character and his qualifications and his future leadership possibilities. And so I asked him, I said, tell me, what's your opponent hitting you on? I'd been in the Senate about 13 years at that point, and I thought that whatever he said, I could help him parry the attack. And he paused and said, "My criminal record." So I speak with some qualifications here. But the role in money in politics is central to the future of our democracy, in my opinion. In 2004, all political campaigns, congressional, presidential, spent $4 billion on campaigns. When I ran for the Senate in 1978, the first time, for my primary and general election in New Jersey, it cost $1.3 million. In 2000, the individual who took my place in the Senate, 4 years after I left, spent $62.5 million. That gives you some idea of what has happened in politics in the last 25 or 30 years. And of course, where does all this money come from? Well, some of it comes from, you know, family and friends that have known you. Some of it comes from people who've worked with you in another field and respect you as a human being. And a lot of it comes from people who are interested in what you would do if you become a United States Senator or are reelected to the United States Senate. And it is that group that presents the problem. It's not the family and friends, but it's the people who make contributions with the expectation of some return. Maybe it's access, maybe it's a little provision, an amendment in the dead of the night, maybe it's a little money in an earmark, maybe it's simply a change of definition. But there is an unstated connection between the contributions and the results. I mean, Barney Frank says, for example, that being a politician, a congressperson, or a senator is the only profession in America where you are required to take money from strangers and pretend that you don't owe them anything. And to a certain extent, that is true. And so we've had an explosion of contributions from, shall I say, interested parties. Just as a statistic, the number of lobbyists in Washington between 2000 and 2006 went from about 16,000 to 34,000. Now, you do the math. Divide 535 people into 34,000. It's like 268 lobbyists per individual representative. And it has been a development that I think has corroded the political process. It is not by chance, I think, that the earmarks, which are those special provisions that are put into appropriations bills by members of Congress, some for your district, which are meritorious, some for interests that are not meritorious, from the period 1996 to 2006, exploded 873%. What is happening is that when Pat Moynihan...
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm amazing. Thank you very much for your concern. When Pat Moynihan, that was Al Simpson for the radio audience, when Pat Moynihan was a senator, he said, you know, 30 years ago, you raised your money from five or six people. They made very large contributions, and everybody knew, they, you know, the press, everybody, those are the people you got your money from, so you can actually keep an eye on your record and see if you were doing anything that benefited those five or six people. But as Pat went on to say, but now we are obligated to a class of Americans who can afford to contribute sizable amounts of money. And indeed, less than one half of 1% of all Americans have contributed more than $200 to a political campaign. So the result is that a lot of times the legislative efforts reflect the money more than the commitment to serve all the people. Bill Moyers has said, think of three professions. You're a baseball player, you slide into home plate, and you give the umpire $1,000 before he makes a call. What would you call that? A bribe, right? Or say you're a lawyer, you made your summation before the court and the jury, and right before the judge renders his verdict, you give him $1,000. What is that called? A bribe, as Moyer says. But if you're a politician, you kind of sidle up to somebody in a skybox at an NFL game and they give you $1,000. What do you call that? Campaign contribution. And that is the problem. And I think that that is why Americans for Campaign Finance Reform is right on target, that what is needed is to take money out of the political process, break the connection between the lobbyist and the legislator. Now, lobbyists can give you information. That's fine. That's fair. But break the connection with the money going. And the way you do that is you go with campaign finance reform, the Americans for Campaign Finance Reform. That's justsixdollars.org. That is six, the number, and dollars, the letters, .org, is building a grassroots effort around the country on behalf of public financing of election. Why is it called Just $6? Because all it would take is $6 from every American, or the equivalent of that, to totally fund publicly all congressmen and senators' elections. It is such common sense, and I think that is why, I underline common sense, that is why that is why it has attracted Al Simpson and I, Warren Rudman, and Bob Kerry, former Senator Bob Kerry, as proponents of this, because we have been there, we have seen what happens, and we know that there is a better way to make legislators more responsive to the broad mass of Americans, and not simply, or shall I say, disproportionately to those with money. There are specific questions which I think we can get to, but I think the main point here is that I think I see it, I think Al sees it, as a national priority. God knows, if 2004, $4 billion was spent, what's it going to be this year? $8 billion? When's the limit? And who makes the contributions? And who sets up all the shadow committees and so forth? And there's only one way to come back, and that is to let the people totally control the process, and they do that through public financing of elections.
Senator Bradley, thank you. Again, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California on the radio. Our speakers today are two former United States senators, Bill Bradley of New Jersey and Alan Simpson of Wyoming, here to talk about their support for publicly financed campaigns. We now welcome former Senator Alan Simpson to make his introductory remarks. Senator Simpson served in the United States Senate from 1979 to 1997, Republican senator from Wyoming. He was also the Republican whip in the U.S. Senate from 1985 to 1996. My favorite quote from Alan Simpson, at least it's attributed to him, by the way, is, "If you have integrity, nothing else matters. If you don't have integrity, nothing else matters." Senator Simpson.
I said that. Let me say, Dave, thank you. It is a great honor to be here. It's not my first time at the Commonwealth Club. I haven't been here five times like Bradley, but I at least showed up, And it's a special treat to be here with Bill Bradley. We came to the Senate together, and we left the Senate together after 18 years. Based not on disgust with the process or anything, just that there is another life to be lived outside of the United States Senate. And I guess our friendship gravitated because of trust and respect, which are the coin of the U.S. Senate. There is no other coin there. Trust and respect, doesn't matter what party you're in. So he's a great friend, and I played basketball too. At the University of Wyoming with the Cowboys, and I was listed in the statistical column as Others. So they called me Others Simpson, and it was a brutal, painful thing I think of even to this day. And the reason we moved our chairs is we realized that when you're 6'7", 6'6", you could easily lose all the circulation in your leg sitting on that stool. I said, my God, I can't even move my knee. So we're here in our new surroundings, and we have Dave situated. And I want to answer a question. Some lag nailed me out there just as I came in, and I was just flummoxed. I didn't know how to respond, but I want to respond right now to him. And the answer is, yes, I did sleep in this suit. And, I hope that'll take care of that smart... Well, where I came into this game, I was privileged to be the assistant majority leader of the Senate. When Bob Dole was elected to the majority leader post, Bill and I had been there 6 years, and there were 20 of us that came into the U.S. Senate at the same time. It was the largest class in the history of the Senate, I believe, historically. 11 Republicans and 9 Democrats, and you know their names. Bill, myself, Nancy Kassebaum, John Warner, Carl Levin, Jim Exon, Dave Pryor. Wonderful group of Thad Cochran that I mentioned. Wonderful group of people. And we used to meet once a month to talk. And Howard Baker was the leader of the Republicans and Robert Byrd. And they said, well, what are you talking about? We said, well, how to answer the mail, and how to avoid your staff, things that are critical in life in Washington. I want to warn people, too, about staff deprivation. It's a very serious thing, staff deprivation. And I'd been out of the Senate a year, and my wife, charming lady, Bill knows, and she said, Alan, your staff is gone. You have no staff. They are not here. And I am not one of your staff. So, that got that out of the way. Now, so as assistant leader of the Senate, and Bob Dole the leader, and George Mitchell on the other side for a time, and Robert Byrd, I can't tell you the nights and the days, and Robert Byrd worked us into the night. He that was what he did. That was his life. It's still his life. He's an amazing man. He is the heartbeat of the U.S. Senate. Even with his serious health problems, Robert Byrd, an amazing, amazing man. So he liked to keep us there at night, and then Dole thought, well, I should continue that. But what happened was, during the afternoon, they would come up, they being Democrat and Republican, say, and I hope that you'll hold over any votes for tonight, because I can be here tomorrow at 10, but please hold the vote. And Bob would say, what for? Well, I have to be at a fundraiser in Detroit. I have to be at a fundraiser in Cleveland. I've got to fly to San Francisco. They've got it arranged. And let me tell you, I remember Bob got up one evening and he said, I thought you people were paid to work. And we are working here, and I'm not going to hold up votes anymore, so you can just run around America and gather up money. And that's what we did. And that's what they're doing now with 7-league boots. I don't think there's any legislating even going on with the money they have to raise. And I'll tell you what it cuts into. It cuts into the work product. You cannot, it's deeper than the perception of morality or greed or perceptions of corruption. The real issue, you can't do your work because the Republicans are coming to town. The Eagles have landed. That's $25,000. I don't know what the Democrats landed with, condors or whatever, but what did they bring? $25,000 a pop in there? Whatever.
Something close.
And so they'd say, they're coming, and you have to get on the phone and call. Go over to the Republican Party headquarters. You couldn't do it from your office. That was a, quote, clear idea, which was violated continually. Go to a little cubicle so you could raise money. And you go in there and take a, like selling stock in a bucket shop, and you're on the phone dialing people for money. And meanwhile, your bill is in committee the next day, but you're not working on it. You're not paying any attention. Your staff is working on it. I can't tell you, it was the most frustrating thing. So finally I said, I'm not making any calls for the president's dinner. To hell with it. Well, what are you going to do? I said, I'll come and speak to their group at their lunch. You gather them up and I'll come in there and say something, or evening or reception. So that's what I did. And I just refused to do it. And I found it demeaning. I'm a legislator. I could not be an executive of anything. I couldn't administer my way out of a paper sack. So governor, president, those things meant nothing to me, but legislating meant a lot to me, and I was rather successful at it. And so it disrupted the Senate. It disrupted the workflow. Just didn't look right. I think Fritz Mondale said it best. Well, it may be legal, but it looks like hell. And that's what it is. And so here we are working on this issue. It's a start. People will have all sorts of sharpshooting ideas. I know you have some. And they'll say, public financing, I got taxpayers' money to pay for those sons of... I know you have that in your head somewhere, roosting in the back of your cranium, is that question. But I'll tell you, gang, you don't want any more of this system. There were $64 billion in earmarks, and I'll bet you 75% of them were things that came from a campaign contribution that never went through the authorization process, never went through the appropriations process, but when it came midnight at the OK Corral, last night of the session, you got the call from the guy that maxed out. He maxed out on you. He and his wife both maxed out. And they gave you the whole load in the primary. They gave you the whole load in the general. And they're on the phone. Hey, Al, you know, that little tariff there, you know, it's not a tax, Al. It's just a tariff. I knew why I flunked that course. I said, it seems like they're kind of alike. Oh, no, you don't understand. You just don't get it. And so there they are, making their final push. And you stick it in there and... I get the new fence for the Elk Refuge, and Kennedy gets the new Witches Museum contribution. I was perfectly happy with that switch. I said, "Take your Witches Museum, Ted, you fink, and give me the fence around the Elk Refuge." And it's funny, but it ain't funny. But that didn't come from campaign contribution. I'm talking about the people who call for a change in the Internal Revenue Code. A change here, something that has to do. But anyway, I think I would just say to you, you remember the hearings they had about the guy who they had him under oath, and they asked him why he gave $300,000 through various, quote, legal sources to the campaign for the presidency. And he just laughed. He said, "What the hell do you think? Access. There's no other purpose that I'd give $300,000 to these jerks. It's just access, and I got it. I was in that White House all the time." You can get anywhere in the White House for $300,000 under either party. So anyway, we have this interesting exercise. It's not perfect, but it's a start. It's like getting the horse on the track, and then next year we'll get the blanket over it, and then we'll throw a saddle on it, and about 6 years we'll put a jockey in the middle of it, and at least we'll get a start. And John Rao has been a splendid chairman of the board there, and we're ready to go because all four of us are very dear friends, and we've all taken a ton of crap, so there isn't anything more you can throw.
Senator Simpson, thank you. Again, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California on the radio. Our speakers today, two former United States Senators, Bill Bradley and Alan Simpson. We have lots of questions. I think everyone in the audience has submitted a question, so we'll try to get through as many as we can over the next half hour. And let me just try to group a couple of thoughts here initially, senators. One person writes, given the climate of corruption, won't it be hard for Congress to finally put rules in place on this problem? And another person asks, it's important to have financing in place, but don't we need essentially better candidates for that to occur? So it speaks in some ways to what both of you hinted at, I think, that there are it's hard to make this happen given the current climate in Congress.
There is not a member of Congress or in the Senate, now there might be a couple, but I'd say the vast majority that would not like to have this yoke lifted from their shoulders. Nobody likes calling up strangers and asking them for money. And nobody likes appearing that, yes, and you understand their problem, which is code for call me after the election. And I think that what's needed is for the public to give them permission to play to their better angels and to overcome the undertow of current Washington politics. And that is not going to happen out of the blue. It begins with Americans for Campaign Finance Reform, just6dollars.org. If you want to help, you go to that site. And I'll tell you the next step. If enough people go to that site, you then set up meetups, which are groups that get together to meet about common interests. Now, you know, for full disclosure, I'm on the board of that little company. But it essentially, there are meetups and 5,000 subjects around the world on Elvis, on taxes, on institutional investors, on whatever. And you could establish just $6 meetups all over America. And if enough people decided they were going to go to the Starbucks or they were going to go to the coffee house or they were going to go to the McDonald's on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock with the full commitment to public financing and brainstorm about how they were going to make it happen, how they were going to go to the contribution charts of their congressperson and find out who were the big contributors, and then go to their homes and tell them, as a citizen has a right to do, that they want campaign finance reform. They want public financing of elections, and you give the reasons. You can make that change. The biggest obstacle to this happening are people's cynicism and defeatism. This is America, after all. And with the internet, you can organize things so quickly that the pressure can be brought to bear so easily on this subject because it is so right, viewed from all perspectives, that sure, 57% of the people in America now say that bribery is a way of life in Washington, according to a CBS poll, but that can change overnight. But as long as you just believe that and you don't do anything about it, guess what? It's going to stay the way it is now.
But how do you overcome, Senator Simpson, that cynicism that you hinted at? You said lurking in the minds of many people here today was that feeling, well, why should taxpayers' money go to those so-and-sos? Given the low regard that many have for your former institution, how do you convince people that that's a good taxpayers' investment?
Well, you do a grassroots campaign like this. This is what we're doing. We're going to reach out. We have an organization. It's not just flapping one wing. We're in flight, and we think that through the internet and through things like this. But I'll bet, and Bill would join me, I didn't know a lot of crooks in Congress. There are not a lot of crooks in Congress. That's a phony baloney. And it's very sad. And we all got nailed with it. I didn't like it. And you wouldn't like it either. A stereotype, which is phony. And then every time they find one of those little gems, that's 24/7 news for 3 weeks. jerk of the year, you know, and they're all the same. And the climate of corruption is not, you know, just with Republicans. If there is a climate of, you're going to be reading about Jefferson now for 3 more months, after we finish with Cunningham for 3 months, and then there'll be other, maybe 5 or 10 guys wearing orange jumpsuits at the end of the year. And so what? There are 535 of us. I get offended by that. Doesn't answer your question, but got a lot off my chest, I wanted to tell you. Now, but you talk about better candidates. Well, as long, you remember the talk of Vaclav Havel? Will you ever forget the talk, the joint session of Congress? He said, if intellectuals in the country are just going to make fun of people who run for office, I, a playwright, would never be the president of Czechoslovakia. Man, it was a punch out. And he said, and when the intellectuals sit it out and just snipe from the edges, they're the first ones to go when you get to anarchy. The first people that get their heads lopped off are the people who sat out there above the fray. But I want you to look at these candidates for president. That's an amazing array of people, both parties. A couple of jerks, yeah, but look at the array of people running for president on both tickets, and we know them. We know Chris Dodd. We know Joe Biden. We know these people, Rudy. And so, you know, if good people get in and we can do something like this to remove the hideous part that robs them of their enthusiasm because their staff is hanging around them like a poor relative all day telling them to go raise money. And that can be the difference. You start. I've always been a guy that started. What the hell? What do you got to lose by starting?
And what people don't understand is how cheap this liberation would be. It's $1.8 billion per year out of a $2.6 trillion budget. Now, we spend almost as much money in that budget promoting democracy abroad. And last year, as Al said, earmarks were $64 billion. So if this was an investment, you'd say your return on that investment, let's assume it reduces the earmarks by $10 billion or by $20 billion. You're almost getting 10 to 1 on your return. So it is so easy to do. It is not some bewildering thing that, you know, all the people think it can't be done. It's very clear. The cost is very modest, and the return is enormous to the taxpayer.
Here's a question from an individual who wants to know, if Barbara Streisand can use her talent for music to give a free, quote-unquote, concert to assemble a few thousand voters to hear her chosen candidate speak, why shouldn't I be able to use my talent for making money to give my chosen candidate some additional television time?
Well, be my guest. The point is, Barbara Streisand gives some time. A lot of it is issue-oriented. She raises some money, but that's not working. That's not good. I mean, America is a free place, sure. You can do anything you want. Well, let's have her out on a picket line, or let's have you, whoever asked the question, out at the home of the people who make the big contributions to a candidate, arguing for them to do something when they're elected about health care reform, education, or pensions in America. You get to a point where democracy grinds to a halt. And that has happened before in American history, happened in the 19th century. And what happened was there were breakthroughs, and we amended the Constitution, and we gave women the right to vote. Can you believe it? Can we imagine a time when half the population could not vote in America? Well, that was a little less than 100 years ago. That began whenever senators who were appointed by state legislatures were simply on the payroll of the railroad companies that controlled the state legislatures. What happened? We did direct election of senators. So when a problem occurs in American democracy, we have a means to change it. And one of the ways to change it would be a constitutional amendment that said that state, federal, state, and local governments may set the total amount of money spent in a political campaign. That would limit the amount of money. But even if we had that, we would need public financing of elections to remove all of the taint and the wasted taxpayer dollars that result from our current financing. So you make certain compromises, yeah? You decide what's best for everybody. And, you know, you might be denied your opportunity to give money to a political campaign, but you know what? If you really cared about health care or education, there are plenty of nonprofits out there that could make better use of it.
There's a lot of attention these days to McCain-Feingold, given that it's once again before the Supreme Court. So here's a question on that, Senator Simpson. Could you enumerate what you think are the fatal flaws of the existing McCain-Feingold law? Is it working overall? And why are current political operatives, like someone like Jack Abramoff, able to prosper? But perhaps focus on the first part. What's wrong with McCain-Feingold that public financing would fix?
Well, first I want to remind people that Wyoming was the first government in the Western world to give women the right to vote. I knew you'd like that. 1869, we were a territory, and then we had the first woman governor, Nellie Taylor Ross, a Democrat, who later went on became director of the Mint. A wonderful woman, lived to be 100.
In case you want to know a little arcania about Wyoming.
I thought it was a very tender thing that I was sharing.
The first one was very moving to me. The Mint was not.
But I talked about signing money.
Yeah. Now I know where you got it. You wanted to imitate
her. That's why they called you Dollar Bill, you cheap... Oh, no, swear. Anyway, now...
We don't want this to degenerate into name-calling.
No, we don't. I don't want to see any of that here, and I didn't intend to ascribe to it at all. Now, as long as Mitch McConnell is in the U.S. Congress... and his friends on the amicus brief, they will cut that bill to ribbons. I voted for it because it's a start. The enemy of perfection is the enemy of anything. There is no such thing as a perfect anything. In fact, what I have found in political life, the people who demand perfection from politicians are the least perfect people I know. They have decided to bring their dump truck and give you the crap while their imperfections go unheeded. And they demand perfection out of you, and their own perfection is very frayed. So I wanted to throw that in. But anyway, I voted for that. Went to the Supreme Court. Boy, they fought it tooth and nail. John McCain is, I don't know how he's handling it in the... It's like immigration. They say your bill failed. I said, yeah, sure as hell did, because we couldn't get a more secure identifier, because every time we talked about it, here came the right saying this is a national ID. Furthermore, it's Nazi Germany and tattoos. Well, I'll tell you, that'll take, you know, if you want to beat something or pass it, and you've run out of facts, you use emotion, fear, guilt, or racism. Don't ever forget that. Emotion, fear, guilt, or racism will plow the ground when you've run out of facts. And that's what happens in all of these things. McCain-Feingold, you know, was a start. And so if you want to go back to zero, well, that's what we'll do. Immigration, this bill is a start. If they want to go back to nothing, they'll have 20 million illegals to play with the next time instead of 12. They say, well, why don't we get rid of them? I say, yeah, well, it'd be a great country to be on the hunt for 12 million people when you don't know how the hell they got in. How do you go hunt them to get out? I mean, it's goofy. Well, I didn't answer that question either, but anyway, it's just, it came from emotion of taxpayers' money. Why the hell do I have to pay my hard-earned taxpayers' money for a bunch of jerks to run for the U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress? That's what it is, and that's pretty emotional. Can't beat it. But if you want to continue to lay out $64 billion for earmarks that you'll never see, be my guest.
Here's our next question. This person writes, isn't public campaign financing hopeless because people refuse to permit their tax dollars to support candidates they dislike? That's one of the frequent objections you hear to this. People aren't interested in it because it would go to candidates they dislike. It would go to candidates who represent perhaps a particular fringe. How do you respond to that, Senator Bradley?
I think that's the view of an individual who has lost sight of the whole. You indeed, you know, some of your money might go to some person who's Republican, my God, if you're Democrat, or who's Democrat if you're Republican. But the virtue of that is that it's your money going to them, and it's not the National Tobacco Association or manufacturers or this guy or that guy. And so the whole benefits, and the whole benefits by giving each side enough money to make its case, and then let the people decide.
And should there be any restrictions to that? Are you comfortable with a bill that would provide candidates? A frequent example that's given is the candidate from the KKK.
Well, no. I mean, I don't think under the approach that Just$6.org is advocating, you would have an independent commission that would meet. One of the most successful things happened in our tenure was something called the Base Closing Commission. What was that about? That was about the end of the Cold War. We had 10 times more military bases than we needed, but nobody would vote to close a base in their district and so forth. So what they did is they established a commission, or we established a commission, that would on the merits decide what bases would be closed, and you'd present them all up and down for a vote. And you would do the same thing here. You'd have an independent commission. You'd provide guidelines in the law of what kind of things you'd like to see that would determine how you provided the public funds. And if there was a third party, if they ended up getting a large number of supporters, they would qualify. I find it impossible to believe that the KKK would qualify because they don't operate in the light. They operate in the dark. And it is what we want is to bring light to the process, make it transparent, give people the money they need to make their cases, and let the people decide.
Speaking of bringing light, there are a number of questions asking about the role of media. One person writes about what you think of the idea of requiring broadcasters to offer free time to candidates. Another about if there are alternatives to expensive television ads. Couple more about the role of the internet. You want to tackle that, Senator Simpson, whether there are good alternatives that would bring more light through the media?
Let me first say I'm a member of the Commission on Presidential Debates, and we'll start our work now picking a locale and format. And we have already figured out how to get rid of the KKK or any fringe outfit because we have, I think it's a provision, there has to be 15 national polls that describe that this group is below a certain percentage in the United States, and then we just scrub them. That's why Nader was furious, because he couldn't reach this percentage figure. He sued, failed. So there are ways to clean out. Again, this is a use of emotion, fear, guilt or racism. Throw in the KKK. Geez, that's a good one. Oh, God, did you hear what that guy said about the KKK? I mean, anybody can do this game, but it doesn't help a bit. Now, the media, free time, man oh man. I went back to Wyoming. Remember that free time bill? Got to Lander, Wyoming, KOLR something, radio station. A guy comes up and says, hey, great, Al. Great to see you on this bill. It says 1 hour a week, free time. I got three kids. I have to feed them. What the hell do you think I am, a millionaire? That's the jerkest thing I ever heard of. You want to go hit, you know, somebody big in Frisco or L.A., go do it, but lay off of me. Try that one. This is the guy that's you paid, you know, when you campaigned to put your spots on the air. Let me tell you, that's going to be a tough one. Free time to a guy in Riverton or Lander, Wyoming is a lot different, but wherever it is, they don't like it, and the National Association of Broadcasters is tougher than a boiled owl. And they handle us.
If I could have a slightly different view on that one,
yes,
I don't disagree about the difficulty, but I think that we shouldn't lose sight that television licenses are basically gifts from the public, from us. And it used to be that they came with certain requirements that you had to provide coverage of public issues in your area. And it's become boilerplate. Instead of having every 3 years, you as a TV station having to demonstrate that you do fulfill this requirement, it's now every 8 or 9 years, and it's become nothing but boilerplate because successive FCCs have not focused on it. If it's every 8 years, it's, you know, you could be a president for 8 years and you'd have another administration before you had after, then you'd work on the other administration. So I think that that's an important point about if the public owns the airways, one of the things the public could require, as it once did, is that a certain amount of coverage be devoted to covering public issues, a part of which could be campaigns.
And Bill, you have to admit, you have to admit that that spectrum licensing is what's called is pretty cheap when you look at the bottom line of these big media companies now. And don't think they're into news; they're into entertainment. You're not getting any news; you're getting entertainment and beautifully coiffed people. So that's what you're getting. And they make a ton, and we sell those spectrum licensing. I think you put an amendment to raise those sums as to, because it's peanuts compared to what they then run off with. Mm-hmm. And we should nail them. You can just say, look, you got that as a real deal. I'm not giving up. You got a good deal there, and now you're going to do free time. I think it's well worth it, and I think we could get it, but it'll be tough.
A number of people are asking about the idea of mandatory voting, something that happens in Australia, for example, and whether or not that would reduce the need for campaign finance reform because everyone would have to vote anyway.
Well, I think mandatory voting is an interesting idea. It's been debated a lot in political science circles. It exists in, as the questioner said, in Australia. But before we take that step, let me suggest another idea.
Oh, listen to this one. This is good.
I heard it.
Yes. I'm not.
Let me suggest another idea.
No, use that one.
The United States is 139th in the world in terms of the number of eligible voters who actually vote. The questioner probably knew that. Italy is number one. At 92%. We are at a little under 50%. Why don't Americans vote? Well, if you ask them why they don't vote, the largest number say, because there's a conflict with work. Because I got to be at work at 7:30, 8 o'clock, I get to the polls, I can't get back till 7 o'clock. So let me ask you a question. Why do we vote on Tuesday? This is a bright audience. I do not see, for the radio audience, one hand being raised to explain this. 1845, before that, states voted on different days. People said we ought to have one national day to vote. Couldn't do it on Sunday, a Sabbath. Couldn't do it on Monday because it takes a day to travel to the place where you're going to vote. Wednesday's a market day, so voila, there it is. It's Tuesday is the day. Well, it's a little over 200 years later. I didn't see any horses or buggies out there. And in the streets of San Francisco. So an easy answer. Before you go to mandatory voting, move the election to Friday and Saturday. Is 2 days of voting too much for the world's greatest democracy? In my view, it merits a try. Other states have had, some states have had other experiments that are pretty good. One is in Oregon, where you can vote by mail, and you vote by mail weeks in advance. The other is in Texas, where they have in some places elections where the polling booths, you can vote in supermarkets and any number of other places for up to 3 weeks prior to the election. There are a lot of answers to this problem before you go to mandatory voting. And the spirit of the questioner I identify with, because if you'd asked me a question 10 years ago, I would have said, well, we ought to have mandatory voting, but I think there are better ways.
Just a question about lobbying. How do you propose to disassemble the lobbying industry that has grown so very rapidly? Senator Simpson, what are your thoughts on that, especially given that Congress has passed some aspects of lobby reform?
Well, we try to keep lobbying reform separate than what we're doing. There's a reason for that. Lobbying reform is almost impossible. Because then you're talking about the grassroots, and we call it AstroTurf, but they call it grassroots. It's like the AARP. The AARP are 38 million Americans bound together by a common love of airline discounts. And they say that they are not a lobbying agency. Let me tell you, they're tough, tough, tough. And they're not interested in their grandchildren one whit because they've seen them walking on their pants with their hat on backwards, and they're thinking, he didn't even send me a thank you note for Christmas, this little snot. They don't give a whit about them. So you can't. And then AIPAC, they're not a lobbying organization either. Oh, man, I'll tell you. You know, now don't, and if you're into that, then you can get into anti-Semitism and everything. I said, wait a minute, I voted for Israel 90-95% of the time. My parents lived there for a time, and see, you use that. Then again, you're into emotion, fear, guilt, or racism. This is how it works. You can't pick an issue where nuclear high-level waste. Well, they won't ever come down my highway with that. Oh, God bless you, sir. Well, I tell you, there are 106 reactors with 47,000 metric tons of stuff sitting right next to them under 60 feet of water, and we're doing nothing with it. And if it became recritical, it would crackle within 10 to 20 days. What do we do with it? Nothing. What do we do with the population of the earth? Nothing. Because then you're talking about religion, ethnicity, contraception, abortion. See where you've taken yourselves? And you've taken the Congress people with you. You elect them.
But isn't the connection to lobbying and
well,
what you're
doing I understand, that... Well, I understand your point, Dave. And if you wanted to have the best lobbying reform bill that could ever be passed, it would be public financing. Because... Instead of trying to control whether I can take a pen set from somebody or a pennant or a T-shirt, and I have to keep hundreds of records as a senator, make sure that I'm complying with this nitpicking, micromanaged law under the guise of lobbying reform, just cut the blood supply. Cut the blood supply, and... You can help do this by going to just6dollars.org and be a part of this movement.
I made a terrible error there. We did an op-ed piece which said lobbying reform is not enough. It is a very important part. So when I said we keep them separate, I don't mean it. But we can't. That's not enough. And this is what Bill says. This is the way to solve that.
Here's a question that doesn't, again, connect directly, but there is, I think, a relevance to it. And this person writes, what are the prospects for some kind of unity in 2008? Is there any sort of rise and an urge for bipartisanship? I think people watching the two of you and the way in which you work together, both in the Senate and since, there seems to be, at least among some people, a sort of hunger for more of that to take place. And surely that would need to take place if something like public financing would ever become real.
Well, Bill and I did a little shtick a few weeks ago about civility. And people say, whatever happened to you out there in Congress, you know, kind of a beady-eyed look at you like that. I say, well, I hear an point, it's very important, but why don't we take a look at the city council chamber first, the county commissioner's chamber first, the school board meetings first, the cheerleaders chopping up each other's mother, the little league ballpark, the hockey game, you know, with the big sticks. It didn't start at Congress. Civility starts down below. And there's a lack of civility that's total in local government. I see it in Cody, Wyoming. City council sitting high above the poor peons in their chairs, looking down while you make your supplication to them. And it's just the lack of civility is all over America, not in Congress. And it's sad to watch. I think the entertainment industry, it was our friend Pat Moynihan, he said, the entertainment industry has debased America. If a Republican had said that, they would have torn the temple down. But he said it, and there it is. Sitcoms, smart-ass parents, smart-ass kids, sarcasm, cynicism. The soaps consist of the horniest people in North America, scratching at every orifice. Well, enough of that. And I believe I'm not going to go any further than that.
Okay.
No, I think I don't want to.
I would answer that question.
Well, I hope you'll do it better than I did.
Without reference to Senator Simpson's last point, by saying I think the biggest lie perpetrated in the American public in the last 25 years has been this idea that the country is irrevocably divided between red and blue. It is just not true. There were 23 states in 2004 where the losing party had over 45% of the vote. It is, and what causes this idea? It's a figment of the media elite and the Washington elite who live on this polarization. I would ask you, when you go to your kid's Little League baseball game, you look at the person next to you and deep down in your core heart say to yourself, I wonder if they're red or blue. I don't think so. They're the parent of the shortstop or the left fielder. We agree on so much more in America than we disagree on. Alan Simpson, I'm not sure that he can argue that the immigration bill in 1986 didn't work. I think it worked for a number of years. And he's the architect of that. And I went to him. I was a Democrat. He was a Republican. I went in with 20 questions, 25 questions, asking him and me, not staff. At the end of it, I said, well, I'm with you. You answer my questions. I did not even know what the Democratic position was. And the American people agree on a lot more than they disagree on. Every American wants a good job, a good pay. They want pensions. They want a good pension at the end of life. They want health care for their kids. They want education for their family. Every American wants that. So why don't we focus on that? The answer is the way we do congressional district lines. The extremes control. Republican legislatures, Democratic legislatures try to maximize their respective party seats. And once you're there, you're in a 60-40 district. If you're in a 60-40 district, I don't even have to listen to a Republican. But what I got to worry about is that primary challenge from my left. And therefore, I'm going to take the most extreme position to avoid that primary challenge. Republican does the same thing on the right. The result is there's nobody doing work on what the bulk of America cares about, which is health, pensions, education, and a good job at good pay. So you ask me that question, I say, Unity 08, I mean, it exists today. It just has to assert itself and hold politicians accountable for what you want, not what they need to stay in the current system in Congress. And the way you change that is you go along with Governor Schwarzenegger, who says we ought to have commissions draw congressional district lines. I agree with that.
I do too.
Unfortunately, we're about at the end of our hour, so we just have time for a last question, and perhaps you can use this as a way to make a last comment as well. This person writes, if you're successful in achieving public campaign financing, how should ordinary Americans who want to influence the political process invest? So as a last thought, if you're successful, what is it that you would most like to see ordinary Americans do? Senator Bradley first, then Senator Simpson.
First thing, vote. Half of them don't. Okay? Second thing, do a meetup on an issue that cares. Third, volunteer some of your time in your community on the issue that you care about. Fourth, personally know your congressman, or the, at least get to know who the people are that support him, and make sure they understand your priorities for their action. And the most important thing, which unfortunately, as Al says, given the media today, is not very well fulfilled, stay informed. If you don't know how we're going to make Social Security solid for the long term, how do you know if the politician you're talking to is telling you the truth or not? Because you haven't spent enough time figuring it out. How do you know how we clean up global warming? You're going to just guess it, just give it to people? So stay informed. Those are the ones that I would say.
Senator Simpson.
Well, I think it'd be refreshing if we get this done where a person goes to Washington or Sacramento or Cheyenne and sits down with their elected representative and just tells them something from their heart, knowing that there's nothing there but a person who's concerned and up to speed and says, there's a bill out there which is so-and-so, and let me tell you how it affects me. I don't give you any money, but here's what it does to my industry. Here's what it does to what who I am. And I think that would be quite refreshing. And I always try to imagine when I was in politics, how would I feel if I were making an entreaty of this person? And there are plenty of people who don't respond. They're looking at you with the thousand-mile stare because you're out there simply as a figure of a person who maxed out twice. And that's who you're going to satisfy. And the vote is terrific because I tell people as they're bitching at me, I'd say, do you vote? No, I don't vote. And I said, well, see ya.
The questioner, the words of the questioner bear some attention. Invest. Where will I invest in politics? Invest in your family. Invest in your community. Invest in a nonprofit. If you're going to invest in politics, invest in your party. That's where you can invest.
We want to thank former United States Senators Bill Bradley and Alan Simpson for their comments today. We also want to thank our audience here as well as on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.